Gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Midwest Monsters Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Grizzly Abner, and I'm joined by
Professor Wagstaff,
Venomous Vinny,
Hot Toddy.
Good to be with you again, friends, as we record over the internet.
Coronamania.
Still, yep, Coronamania is still happening. We're still in the grip of the pandemic.
It's running wild.
Yeah, gonna run wild all over you, brother. And so Toddy and I are on location together, but Vinny and Professor keeping their loved ones safe by not joining with us. And so here we are. So again, as usual, please excuse the drop in audio quality as we do this. So we're getting together tonight to bring you another installment of the Monster Mash. And I'm Grizzly Abner, and I chose Beyond the Gates.
I am the Professor. And I picked Black Sabbath.
Venomous Vinny here. I picked Brightburn.
And Hot Toddy, I picked Arachnophobia.
Okay.
Or Irachophobia, whichever.
So we're gonna go in chronological order. And so we're going to start with Black Sabbath. And that way, as we work our way up, if you get to movies that you haven't seen yet and you want to turn the show off so you can watch them, you'll have that opportunity. So we are starting with Black Sabbath, Hot Toddy, dates and details.
All right. Black Sabbath, 1963, starring Michelle Mercier, Boris Karloff, Mark Damon. I don't know how long I need to go on. Most of these names mean nothing to me. Make sure I don't miss anything. And directed by Mario Bava.
All right.
Thank you. All right. I picked this one basically because, one, I think it's underseen for its value, but in a lot of different directions, historically, there's importance to this film that we can discuss as we go on. But more than anything, it's just an anthology film that I've always enjoyed, so I wanted to cover it. Had you guys seen this one before?
I had never seen it, surprisingly.
I have never seen it. But it was, I opened it for this podcast. It was sitting on the shelf.
Surprise, surprise. I remember seeing the first vignette. So I don't know if I only had seen the first one before or if I'd seen the whole thing before. So it may have been one. It used to be on Netflix years ago. So I may have booted it up and watched part of it and started doing something else. I don't know. So I do know I've seen at least the first vignette before.
Cool. All right, so before we jump in, I do want to clarify that there are very different versions of this film. I treated it as us approaching the more accessible one for us here in the States, but I can point out the differences on the back end of this because there is the original cut, the European cut, and then the one that had all the changes made for the American release, which is the one that predominantly people like you buy the Blu-ray here, it's that cut of the film. But with that said, it's just it's a classic anthology film. We've got a wonderful host in Boris Karloff that is the narrator for it. Yeah, and is also in one of the segments. So with the first segment is Drop of Water. And I'll be honest, Drop of Water is the reason I picked this to cover. This scared the hell out of me as a child.
Was that Betty Davis?
Yeah. So basically, the great thing about all of the segments in this, it won't take long to cover because they're very basic concepts. They're not weighed down by a bunch of nonsense. So with this one,
I do want to pause you there, and I wanted to ask, so why is the first one 10 minutes, the second one an hour, and the third one 2 hours?
Well, originally, the first one was the end of the movie in the European cut. Gotcha. That was the packed punch that sent people out of the theaters afterwards. I don't know if for the American they thought it was better to save Karloff and the longer one for that, but I think it was a mistake. I think that the first segment in this drop of water should have stayed the last one.
If that's how the movie ended, the lights would have been on all night.
Yeah. So the basic premise of that is we have a nurse that is sent over to prepare a corpse for a recently deceased medium. And why she's there, going through that, she steals a sapphire ring off of her fingers. And the process knocks over a glass of water. And from there on out, she returns home to her place where she is just having all kinds of weird occurrences. She's hearing water dripping, and eventually we're treated to the corpse being at her place in her bed. It is this movie's what, 57 years old now, still jolting the little body that they have for her, where
that old lady's scary as hell, boy.
Yeah, so she lifts up, comes towards her, and forces the nurse to strangle herself. And the next day, the officials are inspecting the scene, and all that they've got is bruising on her finger where the mark was. And then we hear the drops of water. So I'm very curious what you guys thought of this segment.
This was my favorite of them. We got to see what Tammy Faye looks like without the makeup. the opening part of the story, because I really don't know anything about the movie, so I didn't know where the stories were going. If he wouldn't have, when he's narrating the film, if he wouldn't have mentioned what each segment had in it, I think each one would have been pretty surprising, because even the vampire segment, I probably wouldn't have got that right away. When she's sitting at the table, when it first opens, and some kind of light outside her apartment keeps making it basically strobe in the other room, I didn't know what was going on, so I just kept looking at the strobe light, and I was like, man, something's going to pop up there. So I think that one had me from the beginning.
Yeah, I like this vignette a lot. It's obviously my favorite of the whole anthology. I love Korloff. Chorus. I like Chorus Barloff doing the hosting. But, the only funny thing I'll say about this one is the ooh, ooh. It reminded me of Marble Madness on Nintendo, when your marble would go off the edge of the board and go ooh.
When you do that, though, it reminds me of like, ooh, baby, ooh, baby.
But no, this one's a straight banger, and this skit is, and I really enjoyed it.
Whatever, on the one that I watched, this was the last vignette.
Oh.
So you watched the European one then.
Okay. It was overdubbed.
Was there more titties?
No titties.
Oh, okay.
But still glamorous European women. But that vignette is scary as shit. And if you watch the cut like I did, it makes sense that it's the third act. I can't imagine watching that one first. Because the imagery in that one was startling at times. It was genuinely creepy. And I'll say this for this one and every one of them, is the scenery is absolutely amazing in this entire movie.
Yeah, good sets.
Yeah, Bava, long before Argento, was doing it. And I think this is a wonderful entry film for anybody who might have interest in that, which is part of the reason I picked it, because to the best of my knowledge, we haven't covered any Bava, and he made some pretty important films. Okay, so the second one, this is the one with the biggest changes between the versions of the film. So in this one, the telephone, and I'm not going to go through beat for beat with it because it'll get really tedious, but basically the gist of it is we have a woman getting home to her place, and she is getting phone calls and terrorized by these phone calls. So in the American version, it is supernatural. In the European version, it's not. And big differences are, is in the one that most people are going to watch here, is we have basically the ghost of her ex haunting her. In the European one, the two women involved, the woman that she calls to come be with her, they're lesbians. And and Frank is a pimp, and she's a call girl. And she has pissed off the pimp who has gotten out of prison. And so they
got him locked away.
Right. And so there was no way they were going to release that in America that way. So they switched it around for the supernatural twist on it, which I think the original version is better. But ultimately, it's not a deal breaker, because the whole premise of it is, we've got to remember, in 1963, we haven't played this to death with the phone calls to the woman at home by herself. So this would have been much scarier than it is watching it now, after all of the movies that have done that over and over again since then. But basically, it results in Frank showing up and killing the friend that she's brought over. And then we still hear him on the phone saying that he will never quit terrorizing her. So, I mean, there's really not a whole lot to it. It's a very straightforward segment.
Yeah. So the one I saw was the European version. There was nothing supernatural about it, which again, when you're putting this together, having the drip at the end and starting with this with zero supernatural elements to it whatsoever, gradually takes you further into fantasy as you watch the anthology that way.
Yeah. Good point. What do you guys think of the segment?
I didn't think it was bad, but honestly, it makes sense that there's two versions, because I kind of, when it ended, I almost was a little lost on what happened. Because I get that she was saying he was dead, but it didn't seem like he was dead. And I almost thought it was like he was going to say he faked his death and shit, and it just kind of ended. But
right.
I don't know. I was kind of a little bit more, not lost, but yeah, it makes sense that that you would say there's two versions of it.
Yeah, the version you mentioned makes a lot more sense, because it's so disjointed, and like, he's dead, and he's calling, and he's ghostwriting on the envelope, but then he shows up and he's not, but then he's dead again, and he's calling again.
Well, let me tell you something that's hilarious in the European version. It's actually her friend who comes over, who has been on the phone doing this voice, by putting a handkerchief over the mouthpiece. And that cracked me up.
So I was expecting the friend too, because when she showed up, I was like, who's this bitch?
Yeah, I thought she'd have been in cahoots with Frank or something.
Yeah. So it's a perfect example of what happens when you got people making creative choices for what they think is going to make more money, because it's a mess. I grew up seeing the dubbed Euro version. That's the one my dad had. And so I thought it was interesting seeing the American version and how different this segment was in particular. Okay.
So this was the middle segment on the American release, heavily edited.
Yes.
Correct.
Wow. Okay.
Wow.
Wow. I don't know.
Okay. And so the last segment is the Vertilact, and we've got basically a very classic tale of vampires. But
it felt very Hammer.
Yeah. The interesting thing with it is it's Russian-based, and a Vertilact, I think, is Slavic. It's a Slavic vampire, but either way, Westerners think of it as Russian, just overall. And yeah, and The Vertilact must drink the blood of loved ones and basically convert the whole family. And so it really taps into some of the upsetting nature that you get into with vampire films, where trusted loved ones are wanting to be let back in the house. something like Salem's Lot, especially does well with that. But we opened the film with Mark Damon, who was in lots of AIP pictures, finding a beheaded corpse and removing the knife from it. He takes shelter that night with a family who points out that that is their father's knife, who had left 5 days ago to go battle the Vertilac. And he eventually returns. This father is played by Boris Karloff.
That wasn't Tim Burton.
Yeah. He shows up disheveled and different. And from there, you can kind of guess what happens. He didn't win the battle, like we suspect. And he is actually there to convert his whole family. And most notably, the little boy, I think his name is Ivan, the character. He gets it, and they're wanting to behead him to protect the family, and you've got the little boy wanting back in the middle of the night, and it's pretty jarring for early 60s cinema.
What a different time, too, that they had the line of like, what, you don't want Grandpa to fondle him?
So, to keep this episode under an hour and a half, I'll just jump straight to the ending and let you know that they don't stave it off. Everybody gets it, and it makes its way through the family. And it's got some pretty creepy imagery. The thing besides the first segment we talked about with the little woman, the thing that always stuck with me the most was the head that he hangs out on the post outside of the house. Mm-hmm. I thought that was so gruesome as a little kid.
That's a good prosthetic.
Yeah.
And one thing I do want to point out is that Karloff really didn't have a lot of creepy roles in the latter part of his career, and this is. He is effective in this role. The scenes of him, like, there at the very end looking through the window, he was not afforded many opportunities to actually be sinister, and I feel like he got that in this segment.
Yeah, I like this segment a lot. Like I said before, it felt very Hammer filmed to me. Mostly because Hammer dealt with a lot of gothic, but I think the costumes, just everything about it. It was interesting to see the vampire lore done someplace different than what you're used to seeing it and have the lore come from. All in all, I really enjoyed it. That's a good segment.
Thanks. Guys?
Yeah, I was indifferent. I was neither very passionate about it one way or the other. I liked Karloff in it. And then the guy at the beginning, he said it was Mark Damon.
Yeah,
Matt Damon's grandpa. And
yeah,
he was really good in it. And so it was just an interesting tale. And so altogether,
also Damon Wayans' father.
But I mean, just a really unique anthology, and for the American version to end with this one, it's just, as I said, this one felt the longest, and so to go from like...
That's half the film.
Yeah, so you've got your banger up first. It's the shortest, it's the best, and then you go to a chopped up story that doesn't even, you know, really go anywhere because it keeps tripping over itself, and then you go to like this long, epic, kind of sad story. It's just really strange. And so it was well done. That third skit was well done, but I was like, what the fuck is happening? Like, where did we, how did we start here and end here?
Man, I think you would have a totally different experience watching the European version.
Probably.
And what's weird about the ending on the European version is this segment ends with him riding off with the child on a horseback, right? Then you go to the drift. Then at the end of that, to wrap it up, is him on that horseback again and closing out the movie, and then they pull back, and it shows him it's on the fake horse and the set and everything.
Yeah.
So it's kind of weird. It's kind of weird when it comes back around.
Get ready for this, Vinny. The American version ends at the very end of this story. It doesn't even have a concluding thought.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yep. That's what even makes it even more weird and disjointed.
Wow.
It's just like, and you're done.
Well, they could have pulled that off too with the drip segment, because you end on Bette Davis. I'm scared. But yeah. Well, this is,
but Boris Karloff like wraps it up as that character on that horseback, and then as he wraps it up, it pans out and you see he's on the back of a fake horse, and there's a screen behind it showing the background, and the guys are running by with tree limbs. And so, I mean, it pulls it back, and you can see the whole set. So, man, I'm so glad I didn't watch the American version.
Yeah, it's much more playful, and I don't think Baba got much say by the time it got over here.
Wow.
Probably not.
So, in the European version, does Mark Damon hang Dom? That's what I need to know.
No.
Mark Damon. So, it was one of those things where the Euro cut's a better cut, but at the same time, I didn't want to make it difficult on us. I didn't know what everybody would be able to
find. That's what I got. And I rented it on Amazon.
Gotcha. And for listeners, too, the Pino put out a Blu-ray that's the American cut. The meat of the movie is there, but if you have access to the European cut, definitely watch it. Now, Grizz, would you like to share a pop culture fact about this movie?
Sure. So, once upon a time, there was a band. And they were actually the merging of two blues bands. One was called, Professor, what was it called?
Earth.
And the other was called Polka Tolk. And they were really kind of bombing, and no one was coming to see them. And they were getting ready to go on, and they looked across the street, or maybe they were going to practice, and they looked across the street, and there was people lined up out the door of the theater to see this movie. And this movie was called Black Sabbath. And they were like, in their British accents, people were going to line up to go see something called Black Sabbath, we should call our band that. And so,
and that's where Led Zeppelin came from.
And so the remnants of Earth and Polka Tolk became Black Sabbath. They got their name from this movie.
Very cool. And one other thing before we move on, is Quentin Tarantino loves this film. And he says that he originally tried to do a crime version of this with his script for Pulp Fiction, which ended up becoming its own thing, but he really modeled it around this with the original script.
Yeah, Uma Thurman looks just like the dead lady from Drip when she's dead.
Get out of here.
All right, Black Sabbath. Anything else to say for the good of the matter?
Nope, check it out.
I
recommend the European version.
I did have a question about it, though, because as I watched it, I saw a lot of Tales from the Crypt. And so I started wondering, and I didn't nerd out like you guys did to research it, but I was just wondering if maybe it was somehow associated with maybe the early comics or something.
Oh, it has to be, because nobody really had done anything like this. That's why, you know, when we watch it now, it just kind of blends in with all the other ones that we love. But, I mean, even the Atticus stuff or whoever made Tales from the Crypt in the 70s and some of those other ones, this was well before that. And so the only thing they would have had to pull from were those comics.
Yeah.
Good times.
So, yeah, I would say if you're going to check it out, try and get your hands on the European version.
Definitely.
For sure.
All right.
All right. Rolling into Toddy's movie. So, Arachnophobia.
Arachnophobia, 1990, starring Jeff Daniels, Julian Sands, John Goodman, Stuart Paquin, Brian McNamara. Make sure I don't leave any. This one's got a lot of small people, so I'm not going to name every single person. And this one is actually directed by Frank Marshall, who was kind of known more for writing and producing. This was the first movie that rolled out Hollywood Studios. Disney's this was going to be their more adult movie instead of all the like Disney kid fare stuff. So, good times. Good times.
All right, you want to give us the synopses?
Jeff Goldblum has arachnophobia, and he
moves. No, Jeff Daniels.
Jeff Daniels. Jeff Daniels.
Okay, I'm talking about the European version.
I wish Jeff Goldblum was in this movie.
Did you guys not watch that one? Jeff Daniels, He's scared of spiders, and he moves into a new town that has spiders. The end. No, I'm kidding. So the movie opens, and it's like in the rainforest, and they're kind of the character we're supposed to attach to is a photographer, and he's already not feeling well. He keeps complaining about how he has a flu, and Julian Sands is a scientist, and they're looking for insects, and they like fog this huge tree, and all these insects fall out. And we see a bunch of spiders, and what they don't see is a huge ass spider that kind of like starts stalking the camp, and it ends up biting the photographer, who instantly has like a heart attack. And I think they kind of blame, they think maybe his flu has killed him, and they box him up, and the spider gets inside. They send him back to his small hometown. Am I wrong?
What no. Know? I'm just saying, I don't like it. I don't like it. I don't like the big spider.
Now you threw me off. Your European stuff. So anyways, a small town gets the body so he can be buried, and spider gets loose and has some spider sex and lots of little babies of highly poisonous spiders take off into the town.
Dun, 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 dun. Dun, 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 dun.
Anybody got any Octomom jokes?
Oh,
just get them out of the way.
Oh, Octomom.
So what's everybody's experience with this movie? Like, have you seen it before?
I have seen this one numerous times. I grew up in a household that loved this little just pocket of Jeff Daniels films that he made. There for a few years in the 90s, he made a lot of really good films that never really took off, with the exception, I think, of Dumb and Dumber. But, you know, this Grand Tour, Disaster in Time, The Butcher's Wife, he made a string of movies that were just particularly popular with my family. So this was one that I was very familiar with.
I just watched this for the first time within the last 6 months. I'd been aware of it, but it had never been like on anything streaming or any place where I could easily consume it. And I think we did a free trial of Shudder, and I was like, "Ah, it's time to watch Arachnophobia." Never seen it, so watched it then. Enjoyed it.
I remember this being advertised in the theaters. I didn't see it then. I saw it after it had come out on home video. I don't remember this being a very successful film after it came out. I watched it. It really didn't hit for me. I remember it feeling flat. Now, this has been over 20 years ago, and I've never revisited it until now.
All right. I saw this in the theater, and I was kind of looking it up because I remember it being popular, but I could be wrong. I remember it came out in summer, and it was kind of obviously it's not Jaws, but it has kind of like that feeling where it was a fun movie going experience, because it's a funny movie, but it's got some good jumps and brings you in. And I remember this is kind of shortly after I started working the video store. I remember it being popular then too. Again, also Steven Seagal and Van Damme movies were insanely popular there. So I was trying to look to see what it actually took in, and it's probably before that shit didn't matter and you could actually make a movie and people liked it or didn't.
I specifically remember being young when this came out, and it had a shit ton of money for marketing. Like, I remember.
Oh yeah, I remember it being everywhere. I don't remember it being terribly well received though.
Yeah, I remember the trailers, the art. It's good cover art. That's probably like some of the end of that era where they actually made cover art. So instead of just putting giant heads of people who are in the movie on the cover art, so.
Good time.
Are we recording?
So what's next, Toddy? What
are we going more into the story?
Sure.
Yeah.
As the story progresses, so Jeff Goldblum, I didn't mention that he...
Jeff Daniels.
Again, I watched the European cut.
Must go faster.
Rack.
And they,
there it is.
And they So what you don't know is in the European cut is he's actually part fly and part dinosaur. And this leads into Jurassic Park. I guess you guys didn't watch that cut. So the American version, I apologize, had, which Jeff, again, Jeff Daniels. I almost said Jeff Bridges.
Could I get a crossover cut?
Yeah, it was he.
Where Dr. Ian Malcolm.
He fought doctors, and then he started selling cars under the name Ford, and played in a had Michelle Pfeiffer play on top of his piano while they fought spiders. Cool movie. Anyways, Jeff Daniels is a doctor, and he has taken over practice in a small town, and it seems like every time he sees a patient, they get bit by a spider and die, and so people start referring to him as Dr. Death. And he's convinced it almost has the Jaws feel where they're like, can't be no spider bite, they're heart attack. And so he keeps arguing with everybody. And as they do realize it's spiders, they bring in a cool exterminator, which is John Goodman.
Yeah.
And then the scientist, played by Julian Sands, comes to the town. And then they're just battling a bunch of big-ass spiders.
Yeah, John Goodman is my favorite thing about this movie.
I always forget until it comes on, but the I always try to, I know it's there, but I can't remember which one it gets it. But the where they go in, and is that the lady that's from Drew Carey? Is that the same actress?
Mimi,
yeah. So the husband and wife, and you know that the spider got him. She was still alive, and when they go in, and he's looking for a spider bite, and it comes out his nose. There's actually a few things that got me in this movie.
I love that everybody in their little town knows that you can't reach them when Wheel of Fortune is on.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to reach them, bud.
They're all getting pumped, getting their popcorn ready.
Real fun side fact. We ventured out to do a little thrifting a couple days ago, and who's the host of Wheel of Fortune? Is it Pat Sajak?
Yes.
There was a Pat Sajak Funko Pop at one of the stores we stopped at. And I was like, all right, I'm throwing in the towel. They've officially gone too far.
Yeah, Ed Grimley bought one.
Who wants that? Do you sit on it? What's the point?
Oh, boy.
You spin it around.
So, yeah, I have a lot of fun with this. Just a fun little spider movie. What else can you say? I mean, like, there's worse spider movies, I'll tell you that. I can't think of a whole lot of better spider movies. And John Goodman, my favorite part.
Oh, I'm sorry, I was still, because I'm nerdy like that. So this was popular. It did $52 million in the box office in 1990, but it came out right on top of Ghost and Die Hard 2.
Ooh.
So definitely got, also Home Alone, I think, and this is June, so Home Alone is still fucking huge. So, yeah, Arachnophobia kind of got drowned out. But, hey, $53 million for a big-ass spider movie in the middle of summer.
But still not the blockbuster those other movies were.
Well, and I think probably being the fact that the producer directed this movie, that they're probably going, like, oh, this is his big go. You know, he directed Tom Cruise and everybody. He's going to take off.
And when you adjust for inflation, $53 million in 1990 is like $300 million now.
It did lead to Congo.
That's not true.
So, hey.
Yes, Congo is the sequel to this.
This movie misses for me. I think it's boring as fuck. I think that it's cliche as shit. The whole setup is very cliche. Everything about it is very cliche. And I think that John Goodman's character, I love John Goodman. I don't think this is his best work, and I think it really smacks of Bill Murray and Caddyshack.
What was his best work, King Ralph?
No.
So, full disclosure here, it kind of lifts from the movie Kingdom of Spiders with William Shatner. Is that why you're sour on it?
Never seen it. Never seen it.
Mm-hmm. Whatever, Tiberius.
I really like this movie. I kind of take... That took a second there. I really kind of take the opposite stance on that, because never once does this film feel taxing. I feel that it kind of is underrated in the sense of, for all of the horror comedies that we celebrate and talk about, this one is never brought up, but it does a really pretty excellent job of never sacrificing completely the scares or the entertainment. It never takes itself too seriously, but it's never too tongue-in-cheek. We actually get a couple of decent jump scares in there, but for me, it just flows. It's not at the top of any of my particular lists, no matter what the category is, but it's just entertaining to me.
I don't think it's awful, but I'll never watch it again.
Well, you like what you like, bud.
I think one of my favorite things about this movie is, I don't know if it's because obviously they made this late 80s because it came out in 1990. So it was right before Terminator 2 and a lot of CGI stuff. But almost everything in the movie is practical effects. And most of the spiders are real spiders because they even had to rig like a boot for John Goodman to where he steps on the spider. It actually just catches the spider and doesn't hurt it.
You cannot animate or articulate a fake spider's legs and it look good. It can't happen. That's why you have to use real spiders.
You mean sci-fi is doing it wrong?
Well, if you need an example of that, just watch the miniseries It, which was around the same time.
I did learn, I was just saying, I was waiting before dinner. I was looking at the trivia facts on IMDb. This one goes way out there with a lot of, like, too nerdy, where, like, I always like to hear bloopers or stuff, but it's like, in fact, if this was a real spider, and I was just like, shut the fuck up. But something I did learn is one of the Mythbuster guys actually created the big-ass spider. So that was probably, like, before he took off for really doing anything.
I saw that. It was, like, his first gig.
All the other facts was kind of like listening to somebody spew about the difference between monkeys and apes, so I kind of blacked out.
And in some languages, quint means four.
It actually means five. But...
Did you say your feeling, or was it because you didn't watch it for this? You didn't do your homework.
No, he said it.
Fired. No, I said I liked it. So I got two words for you. Oh, you didn't know? All right, anything else to say on Arachnophobia?
No, I'd recommend it if you're interested.
Yeah, if you're a fan of the genre, check it out. It's fun. It's a silly little creature feature. So, or critter feature, if you will. All right, moving right along to my pick. Beyond the Gates, Hot Toddy.
Beyond the Gates, 2016, starring Graham Skipper, Chase Williamson, Bree Grant, and never-aging Barbara Crampton.
Never-aging. So this was my pick, and I chose it because I just watched it on a whim. It's got fun cover art, kind of throwback vintage-y cover art, and I thought, why not? We'll give it a shot. It's got a decent lineup. You know, Graham Skipper, kind of a guy on the indie scene, and then of course Barbara Crampton. So watched it a while back, really enjoyed it, thought I'd make you guys watch it, and what's your history with the film?
I'd watched it once before and enjoyed it, and that feeling didn't change with this viewing.
I had not seen it until this viewing.
I had not seen it, and it's definitely something that I was wanting to pick up and I was interested in, and it was not a movie sitting on the shelf.
So, before I jump into the storyline here, killer soundtrack. I mean, they do the fun kind of throwback to the synth pop, Stranger Things style. So we open in the summer of 92. Their dad is opening a video store. It just looks like a lot of fun. He's got Mount Rushmore, but with monster faces, and it's Mount Rush Monster.
Which one would you rather watch Fourth of July fireworks at?
Yes. So then we jump forward to the kind of present day, and these brothers that were having fun with their dad at his video store are now kind of estranged. They show up. You can tell they're kind of distanced from each other. The dad is missing and has been missing for quite some time.
And had a habit of disappearing.
Yeah. And so they are there to clean out his shop. And so that's kind of the setup. And then you got one brother who's serious and the other brother who you can tell is kind of a screw up. And so the Sirius brother now has a girlfriend, maybe fiance, and she comes into town to help him out and to, you know, she's just there to be supportive. And they go to this bar, and the screw-up brother has an even worse, more obnoxious friend, and so it adds to the tension of their relationship. But the next day, this is where we get into the meat of the story, they go back, and they find the key to their dad's office. And once they get into their dad's office, they find these old VHS board games, which some of you will remember, because this story and this board game is a lot like an old board game called Nightmare that was a VHS board game. And they play it at home, and weird things start happening. So I'll pause right there and check in with everybody.
Now, which the one brother was Elijah Wood and Jeffrey Combs had a baby. Which one was that? That's the
Sirius brother.
The Sirius brother, and then there's the cute brother.
Okay. The one that, So Graham Skipper is the Sirius brother, and the cute one, as you say, is the dude that plays John, and John dies at the end.
Oh, that's who that guy is. Can I say that this movie started, and one, I must have missed, I thought it was present day, so hey, it makes more sense. But when they went walking around to about the second row of huge-ass video store, I got a boner.
Oh, yeah. I was like, this is not to bother
all of us. It was present day because they were texting.
I said it starts in 92 when they're little.
Oh, yeah. I heard 92 and I blacked out, so I thought you said it
too. No, then we fast forward to modern day.
I dozed a little bit when you talked.
You're getting old.
You bored me.
Abner, you got CO2 alarms in your house?
I do smell burnt toast.
Your mouth tastes like copper.
Yes. The Grizz over here picking more nostalgia porn. I'm kidding. I didn't know what I was in for. Well, the cover art kind of gives you that feeling that it's going to be kind of a retro feeling movie, which it did deliver on that. Like you said, with the soundtrack was done very well because the soundtrack actually sounded like something made then, not something made to sound like it was made then, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Feels more authentic that way. I was a little trepidation in the beginning of what I was getting into, just because I kind of thought the way they presented the brothers was heavy-handed. Like, there's no subtlety to what these guys are supposed to be, polar opposites. One's the loser, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that quickly dissipates. The video store, of course, for any kid from that era, seeing all that is like, ah, oh, man. All in all, I'll pause there. It had a little trouble selling me in the very beginning, but that quickly went away.
I think it sets the table really well. Something that I think is easy to overlook, but it's important about this film, is that it doesn't go too far with the nostalgia.
Yeah,
right.
It gets you in the mood, but it doesn't lean on it like a crutch, like a lot of movies do, where you're bored with it 20 minutes in. And I think that's kind of what you were saying, Benny.
Yes.
I think that, for where we're at with what we've covered, I just think it really sets things up nicely to where you know enough about the characters without spending way too much time on it. And it just kind of hits you in the right spot going into the video store and all that.
Yeah.
This one got me from the start. I love the beginning. The brothers was a little bit too little hammy, I guess.
It was. It was heavy-handed.
And then, I don't know. At first, I thought the friend was a little bit over the top, but hey, we all know somebody like that. So that's real life. And then I guess that's about where I feel like the opposite of Benny, though. I feel like it got me in from the start, and it lost me a little bit as it went on, but...
So they're home, they're playing the board game, and the host on the VHS board game is played by Barbara Crampton. They're like, oh, this is cute, this is fun, they're playing along, and then the board game says their name. And they're like, wait, what? And so they're like, all right, let's turn it off, let's stop playing. And so they try to stop playing for the night, and so they're starting to get like these weird night creeper sort of vibes, like the Sirius brother keeps thinking that he hears and sees stuff around the house. Then they find Barbara Crampton's photo on the mantle. And it gets even stranger. Like, this chick that's in the video, why does Dad have a photo of her? So they start playing again, and more weird stuff starts happening. So they call their buddy, who's a cop. And he comes over, and he can't see anything on the video. He's like, really, guys? Like, you call me over for this? Real funny. I've had a busy, terrible night. You know, what's going on? They're like, what? You can't see what's on the video? And so they find a receipt inside there for the for this oddity shop where their dad must have purchased the game. And they go, and they talk to the guy at the oddity shop, and he's super weird. He looks like a poor man's Gabe from The Office.
Over the top.
Oh, so you are the ones who bought the game.
This guy felt like the difference between acting on stage and acting in a movie. You know what I mean? Yeah. He seemed so out of place. It was funny.
Like he's like when we talk about those early films, the actors who used to be in the silent films, how they acted once they got in the talkies.
Yes. Yes.
Did you notice his name in the movie? Elric.
Like Elric Kane?
Yeah. The director's friends with all these guys.
Oh, yeah. Nice. So there's mysterious instructions in here that kind of write themselves and change. And they're like, huh, this is starting to look like our backyard. And they go into the backyard and they find this voodoo doll. And they got to get the key out of this voodoo doll. And in the process, this voodoo doll is tied to the shitty friend that was at the bar. And he dies a super brutal death in the bar.
That was pretty fucked up. Blowing out like
it did make me laugh.
Snakes.
Yeah. when it spurted in the like his ex-girlfriend's face, it did make me laugh.
So then another similar setup. They find this other spot where this key is supposed to be in their yard. And their cop buddy who came over and didn't see anything on the tape is now kind of crazy. The tape's been fucking with him in the head. And so they've got this key for his head that they're trying to find in the backyard. And this key is for the board game. And he comes over and he's nuts. And he's trying to kill him. And
he's shooting at him with a shotgun.
Yes. Shooting at them with a shotgun.
Walking like Festus from Gunsmoke.
So they find this key and they remove it from the head, and his head explodes.
His head explodes.
Another brutal kill.
And a good practical effect.
Yeah, both times, both kills, good practical.
This feels exactly like listening to me describe Fulci movies.
Oh, absolutely. Halfway through ranting this, I'm like, I sound like Professor, and I must look like Charlie Day connecting all the conspiracy. So then they find this weird gate in their dad's basement, which is super weird. Then this black metal monster appears out of nowhere. This guy looks like a black metal fan. He's got corpse paint on. He's under their bed, and they kill it. They manage to kill it. And then the last piece is that there's this character in the game that's the crazy maiden. And it ends up being Margot, which is the Sirius brother's girlfriend. She is the crazy maiden. And so they have to try to save her and not kill her. And they try to get the last key to open the gate. You guys want to say anything before we wrap it up here?
Just that I love it when Robin Williams pops out with the long hair and beard.
I was waiting on that this whole fucking time. I was like.
Yeah, one of my notes was
came out looking like Vinny.
This is horror Jumanji.
It does have a very big feel of horror.
The Jumanji. Yes. The COVID version of Vinny looks like Rob Williams when he came out of Jumanji.
What year is it?
8 months on this beard, Claire.
Oh boy. They open the gate. Their dead friends are inside. They come out as these ghouls. And they're trying to stop them, and their dad.
Which is the only way they can set their souls free is by killing them.
Yeah,
with this sword that they stole from the weird guy's shop.
Oh, you'll have that.
Found the sword.
You found the sword.
Was he the same guy that was in the special episode, A Different Strokes, where he took him into the back room?
But, funny, but Todd's always going to take it that direction. I feel I need to take a shower.
Yeah, does the guy work for Wayfair or what? Oh, goodness. Oh, so then their dad comes out.
Get this thing back on the rails.
Yeah, their dad comes out. And it's almost they have to kill their dad to save him, but it's also kind of like this kill for the serious brother that like kind of makes up for all of his anger and frustration that he's harbored towards their dad all these years. And so it gets pretty sentimental. And then when it's all done, they save Margo, they save everybody, and the brothers like each other once again. And so they actually hug. There's been this whole chain throughout the whole movie where they do like these awkward handshakes and hugs. And you can see that like when they connect with other people, they're able to hug and like hang out with them. And then, the brothers hug at the end and, you know, make vows to come visit one another and actually and not, you know, have to fucking murder anyone this time when they do it.
Yeah, something interesting I want to point out is director Jackson Stewart was very, very close with Stuart Gordon. Kind of thought of him as a mentor. And I can remember years back, like when this came out, seeing so much of Gordon and the aesthetic of the film. Not necessarily down to the smallest degrees of execution for it, but this is at times very, not only with the obvious color palettes to it, but it's also playful in a way that like From Beyond was.
Yes.
Or not as humorous as Reanimator, but there is a very gory playfulness to it that is like Stuart Gordon, who I know he looks up to a lot, and I think he should be proud of that it comes through in his film without ripping it off.
Yeah, I would agree 100%. So I'd highly recommend this movie the second time around. I think it's still fun. It's just a fun movie is all it is. And so, I'd recommend it. How did everybody feel?
Well, and it's a chance not to watch something from the '80s. You know what I mean? Like so much of what everybody's horror diet is comes out of the '80s and things of that. Step outside to a decade that's not necessarily known for its horror.
Right.
And give it a try. I liked it.
Yeah. I think it's a rare instance where you can judge a book by its cover. It lives up to everything that poster indicates it will.
Yep.
Yeah, I would recommend it to anybody.
It let me down a little bit as it went on, but I still enjoyed it.
In what way did it let you down? I'm curious.
I feel like it had a stronger hold from the beginning than it did as it went on.
All right.
And I give you credit for that because I think it builds up towards like this epic ending and you think that they're going to go beyond the gate, but you just kind of end up wrestling their buddies in the basement. And I could see, I could see where that could be a letdown.
Yeah.
It would have been called Beyond the Budget.
Yes. Right. And that's one thing. It's a tight movie because you don't get many different set changes. And so you've got this awesome gate in the basement, but you never get to go beyond it and see what's in
there. That's a good distinction to point out, though, so I'm glad that you mentioned that. It is limited in its scope just because this is a true indie film.
Yeah. And then last but not least, Vinny, what's the very last thing we see? Back in the occult store.
Oh, they're back in the occult store talking to the weirdo. Oh, would you like to play a game?
Can you do that as Ned?
I think we found your next character. You're going to be
a shop owner.
Folks, it's not a good impression.
So
Ed, some guy asked, do you have anything from the 80s? And he sells the guy the game.
The board game lands back in the shop.
Yeah. Originally, they...
Triple H comes out.
They're trying to get... they can't afford The Rock in this one. They got to get Crack Rock. And originally, Christopher Wolf was the shopkeeper, so it was going to be like, wow, want a game.
Would you like the game? Now... Ah. Also not a good impression, folks.
I'm on fire. All right. So we're
back, you devils.
I'm not doing Tracy Morgan. Don't try and get me to round this whole thing out. All right. So, wrapping up. We got one more movie left.
I thought you were getting ready to end the show. I was like, damn.
Todd's slipping over here. Doesn't even have the dates and details.
What are you waiting for?
This bitch, I got to pull up.
I was glad it was.
It could have been this or Pornhub, so I'm not sure.
Or Grindr. So, yes, Brightburn. Todd, give him the dates and deets.
Slow burn. Just kidding. Brightburn, 2019. Starring Elizabeth Banks, David Denman, Jackson Dunn, Matt Jones. That's your central cast there. And director David Yerveski. And the names here would be written by Brian Gunn and Mark Gunn. So you may or may not have heard of their brother, James Gunn, who also produced this movie. And that's probably all he did was maybe watch it and say, yeah, it's not bad. And then all of a sudden, James Gunn is all over the posters.
Yeah.
Till he made a racist joke, and then they pulled it. But
Elizabeth Banks, every time I hear her name, I go, who is that? And I have to, like, look it up every time I hear her name. I'm like, oh, yeah, okay, I've seen her in something.
Is it because you don't like woman directors?
I picked this movie, and I'm a Superman fan from back in the early 90s. I collected the Superman books for a long time. This was interesting to me, but I had not watched it. I didn't go to the theater to see it. And I see a lot of comic book movies in the theater, but for whatever reason, I didn't get around to seeing this one. It intrigued me because it was basically a what-if story. Marvel does what-if, more of an Elseworlds is what DC used to do, where they take their classic characters' origins and tweak them to tell a different story. And this is very clearly Superman without the rights.
What if Superman smoke crack?
So they take the whole thing of a barren couple really wants a child. A spaceship lands on their farm. They raise the child as their own. In his early teenage years, he starts to develop superpowers. Except that whereas Superman goes on to become Earth's greatest protector, this kid, it's like Damian from The Omen. Instead of Clark Kent. So I was intrigued by it. It was a newer movie. I don't pick a lot of newer movies, and we don't do a lot of newer movies on this show. So if you don't want to hear anything about it, still want to watch it, turn off the episode. But that is why I picked this, and I kind of wanted to just watch it.
I had not seen this. To be perfectly honest, if you hadn't picked it, I probably never would have. Just because I am absolutely exhausted with superhero movies. So I wouldn't have dug deep enough to jump into this.
Here's an honest question. How long ago did you guys get sick of comic book movies?
Oh, for me, probably 3-4 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Probably 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. 10 years from now.
But with that said, what's important here is that I'm glad you picked it because I really like this movie.
It's weird. I don't think of this movie as a comic book movie. I don't know why. I wanted to see this really bad when it came out in the theater because I go back and forth. I'm not sure if Superman or Batman is my favorite. I'm a DC kid. I'm not really a Marvel kid. I know that's taboo because Marvel's making money right now.
I enjoyed their comics more growing up.
But I was a DC kid. I mean, I would have went and saw Aquaman over the Avenger movie. So,
well, I saw them both.
Well, they ruined Aquaman by getting him out of his little red tights and where he talked to fish and rode a dolphin. That's just what I say.
So, Brightburn.
Brightburn. So when I saw the trailer,
I felt like Aquaman was just this little gay kid.
That's homophobic and insensitive. I don't remember when I first saw the trailer, but my first thought was, how in the hell did somebody not Warner Brothers make this movie and not get sued by Warner Brothers. And I don't think Warner Brothers could have done this because people would have got upset because Superman is, I feel like some of the movies that he's done now, they're like too dark. So I don't think Warner Brothers could ever get away with doing a dark, dark Superman like this.
Superman is supposed to be the purest hero there.
The one of hope. Yeah. So you could get away with doing a Batman movie like this, not Superman.
Right.
So the fact that they're even living in Kansas. So I mean, there's yeah. so much that's
it's Superman down. Without the rights.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm glad you mentioned The Omen because as I watched it, I kept thinking a lot of The Omen. I wanted to see this really bad. I missed it. I was really excited you picked it because I have not had a lot of time to watch movies. And so I really dug it. I'll go more into it as we go. But yeah, that's I wanted to see a purple duck, and so I drew the duck purple.
I remember seeing this on the shelf when it came out. I knew nothing about it. All the crackhead editions were popping up at Dave's video. I remember it was in Redbox, and I was like, what is this? Like, I never even paid it any mint. Like, just never heard anyone say a word about it, so I never paid any attention.
Never heard anybody say anything about it either.
And so when you were like, let's watch Brightburn, I was like, that thing with the weird-looking like kid on the cover? Oh, okay. And, watched it and was pleasantly surprised. It's a good movie. I don't know that I'll ever need to watch it again, but it's a good movie. And
I was surprised by it as well. I really didn't know what to think going into it. But by the end of it, I was like, I ended up liking that a lot more than I ever thought I would.
Sure. I've watched it every day for the last week.
Can I say something that really surprised me about this movie that I didn't expect is the gore, some of the gory shit.
Oh, yeah.
The eyeball scene with the glass. I actually had to look away.
Yes. There is – well, let's get into the story a little bit. So Superman's origin, the kid gets to be 12 years old.
Okay, we just got sued. Can we say, like, Superman?
And then something in the ship that's hidden in the barn, just like Superman, starts communicating with the kid. And the kid starts hearing voices, basically, and is drawn to this ship. So at one point, the parents have hidden it from him. He finds it. Then he finds out that he is not who they've told him he is. He knew he was adopted, but he didn't know he was a thing from another world and this and that. So he flips out. And then he basically starts to think of himself as a superior being to everybody else, that he is something special and to be revered.
And he runs for president.
Is better than anything else. And I have to point out, at one point he falls and cuts his arm on the metal from the ship. This is after you've seen him stick his hand into a twirling lawnmower blade, and it destroys the lawnmower blade.
And they also, the parents
this have pointed actually out. Cuts him, so it's like, oh, shit. That this metal from his own ship can hurt him. So that's important.
The parents have made
as soon as I saw that, I was like, well, I wonder how they beat him.
Well, they also made a comment that they've never seen him bleed or be sick.
Yeah. So this kid starts to get a little creepy. The little girl at school that he kind of has a crush on, he starts trying to be sweet he can control electronics a bit as well. By playing a song for her on her laptop, which freaks her the fuck out. She walks over, closes it, walks back to her bed. It's open again and playing. She puts shit on top of it, and as she walks back, she can see the kid floating outside her window looking in at her. So it's, man, it has some real creepiness to it. And you watch this kid who was like this normal kid. There is a darkness to him, but you see the things that feed that darkness because of what a fucking weirdo this little girl thinks he is, even though he's just awkwardly teenage. It is creepy, but he's awkwardly trying to show her affection.
Well, but she didn't think he was a creep until she saw him outside her window.
Yes. Like,
she was nice to him at school.
Yes.
And yeah. So
you'll get that.
I think this is a glimpse at if every incel on Reddit got superpowers, what would happen?
And Usually those who picked on you are the ones that have crushes on you, you know. I used to get my hands all the time by guys at school.
She's really weirded out by it. One day at school, she flips out because they're going to pair her with him and talks about what he's a pervert, and the kid grabs her arm by her wrist and just squeezes until he breaks it. And that's where things really start to take a turn. And then, like, to keep his secret, to not get in trouble with his parents, he goes to his aunt, because she's the counselor, is like, look, you can't say anything to my mom and dad. Like, basically, vaguely threatens her, and then just fucking starts killing anybody who might out him for what he's doing. And creepily, in the meantime, is leaving calling cards, the symbol that he's created for himself, at the crime scenes. Do we want to jump in here and see how you're feeling at this point?
Well, I was going to say, too, like, the signs are kind of like the Kryptonian stuff from Superman.
A little bit, yeah.
In Superman, it meant hope. And I do like when the spaceship started talking to him and he's trying to figure out what it's saying. Because in Superman, it was like, you know, you're the Earth's hope. And his message was like, just basically destroy the Earth.
Yeah, yeah.
Or was it take Earth?
Something that I found... Something that I found very interesting with this is that it really forced me to look at the parallels between just classic superhero storytelling and the birth of a sociopath. And that's not to say that they're directly playing off each other. It's just how effortlessly it played out like that. I mean, yes. It really got me engaged quickly because even though we're riffing on what we know so well with Superman, and all of those elements, what you're really seeing is the birth of a serial killer. I mean, we've covered it on endless true crime stories already on this podcast. This is how it goes. Somebody tries to control urges and who they are and having trouble fitting in to the point where it eventually gets so out of control that the best solution is no witnesses and the release. And so I think it's a very interesting play on that.
Grizz, you were up next.
I want to say, checking in early, that I really like, one thing I appreciate about the film is that they really did good building that family chemistry. Like,
great casting.
This is a family that cared about each other, loved each other. You had Roy from The Office playing the dad, and of course, Elizabeth Banks. And they gelled really well. And so I think that helped invest you in the story.
That's a good point.
Early on,
I agree.
You cared about them.
The mom makes a lot of points too, to say, you know, because they already know that he's of another world, but she makes a point to say, no matter what, I love you, and I'm going to accept it. This is early on before things grow south, but hey, I love you. You know, you could, and almost like a serial killer again, like where you hear like, I love you, even if you kill people, honey.
when the kid. There is some, like we said earlier, some cringe-worthy shit in this movie. When that woman catches that piece of glass in the eye and then pulls it out, whoo, doggy.
Well, yeah, so you need to, you got to tell the audience that the mother of the girl that he likes, that he just broke her hand.
Yeah.
She's talking about him.
Endless shit.
Yeah, talking about how he's a freak and everything like that.
And his mom takes up for him. He can hear it.
Yeah.
So he goes and kills the bitch.
Yeah, goes to her work at the at the Hungry Heifer,
the Burger King.
Yeah.
And kills her in the bootleg Burger King.
Yeah. There was, and then when he kills his uncle in the car, he lifts the car up in the air and just drops it, and old boy's jaw hits the steering wheel and is hanging. That was uncomfortable to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Uncomfortable to watch. And then, like, the next day when they tell the kid about the guy dying that the kid killed, the kid's just like, okay, I feel like you want me to cry or something. It's this total emotional disconnect, which, like you say, is very much like the serial killers that we've spent time reading about. And that is just total disconnect from what he had done. So this keeps escalating to a point where the dad is starting to put together, our kid's fucked.
I now have to wonder if Bundy would have been raised in Kansas by little loving farmers, would we have had a different ending?
So the dad takes the kid hunting. Knowing damn well the reason he is taking this kid hunting is he is going to put him down like Old Yeller.
That is brutal.
So the kid bends down, and here we are at Of Mice and Men, and the dad aims and pops a shot off, and the bullet don't kill the kid. And the kid looks up with just the betrayal that he's feeling at that moment, that his own father just tried to kill him. So he kills the dad, then goes back to mom, and it's a horror movie terrorization. When the sheriff shows up on the porch, and the kid just flies through him like a fucking flash, and he just splatters everywhere. So the mom runs out to where the ship is, wrenches off a sharp piece of it, and you're like, here we go. You know, this shit that the foreshadowing in the beginning was so obvious. She's
even
hugging
him,
telling him how much she loves him, and she raises the thing up, and right as she's driving it in his back, he catches her hand, which at this point I'm still expecting the thing gets thrown off to the side here in 5 minutes, she'll crawl over to it, get it, and kill him. Spoilers, as it's been all the way through, they don't kill him. They don't stop him. It was a total misdirection. I love him for it. And he kills his mom.
It's excruciating, too. They make it so haunting and chilling the way they do that, because in that moment, you're finding the perfect marriage blending of horror into Superman by him flying her up and dropping
into the atmosphere. Yeah, and then just drops her.
And takes out a plane.
Yeah, and takes out a plane to crash on their property.
Yeah, to cover it up.
And then the end of the movie, you see, it's like a newscast. They're talking about the parents were dead and the kid sitting on the back of the ambulance with a blanket, sipping, you know, a warm drink like you've seen a million times. And then the rest is just like home video and news footage of this being destroying shit. Just wanton destruction everywhere. And that's how you win. He's out doing his thing, his rampage. And I don't know, man. The ending shocked me more than anything in that I thought I had it figured out. They laid it out for you. And it's so cliche, like many comic book movies are now, right, especially, that you just, oh, here we go. At the end, she stabs him, blah, blah, blah. Doesn't play out that way, and I love them for playing it the way that they did.
Agreed.
I think this, like I said, I was excited to see the movie. I think the movie's actually really good. And the gore, it's beyond gore, actually. Like, it's pretty horrific.
Yeah, man.
And great ending that I wasn't expecting either. But there was some weird miss to where I would just think this movie's excellent, because it's still really good, and I would highly recommend it. And this is weird to say, but I almost feel like this movie might have been intended to be made found footage, because it has this weird found footage feel to it, where like a lot of the scenes kind of like jump from one to the other, kind of. I mean, it still makes sense. But other than that, I think it's an excellent movie. I feel like it wasn't as strong as it could have been, but it's still a really good movie.
It exceeded any expectations I had for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would take a little bit of the opposite stance on that, because I think it exceeded what I expected it to be capable of. I was blown away by its bleakness and its courage to own the movie that they wanted to make. As we mentioned, it's very gory, but they stick to it, and they find the perfect blend of still giving you what you would want from this on paper. We still utilize some superhero powers to make him not just your run-of-the-mill evil little bastard. I mean, he's flying through people. He's dropping people in cars, so you're still getting that. But at the same time, we don't lean into that too heavily. And on top of that, we go really gory and then we don't make you feel good at the end about it. I mean, yeah. It completely just caught me off guard. I knew what the movie was a little bit, but it ended up being so much better than I expected it to be. I really liked it.
Yeah, I thought it was a good movie. And I would definitely recommend it to folks. I don't know that I'll watch it again, just because it's not my niche, but I think it's definitely a good film.
If it would have been Kentucky instead of Kansas, he would have it on repeat. That'd be
it. I think that if somebody is hesitant because of the comic book feel to it, do you like Firestarter? Do you like Carrie?
Yeah.
Do you like, what is it, Friday 7?
Do you like Gladiator movies?
Like it's just not that far off of some of the things that we readily accept as horror movies. You know what I mean? But it's not that much different than those that I mentioned.
Do you like Spartacus? Do you like Ben-Hur?
You ever seen a grown man naked before?
Are we going to, hopefully somebody will pitch a feel-good indie movie about the origins, is it of Lex Luthor, where he's just a nice kid?
he's misunderstood. I will say, I've been really excited to see, and God knows when they'll ever put it out. I look for any time than just to dump it on video now. But the New Mutants, which is the horror version of the X-Men, has supposed to have been released the last 2 years now. So
I've heard that, yeah.
After watching Brightburn, I still want to... Like, I heard it's pretty horrific. Then I heard they watered it down, and so who knows what they've done with it. But if it's anything like Brightburn, I think it'll be a pretty cool movie. So
definitely.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for picking it, Vinny. I don't think I'd have watched it otherwise. So
yeah. Good pick.
Good time.
Pleasantly surprised.
Yeah. So, all right, folks. Well, there you have it. Four more movies covered under the banner of the Monster Mash. I am one of your hosts, Grizzly Abner, and I'm joined by
Professor Wagstaff,
Venomous Benny,
Hot Toddy.
Good to be with you, friends. Hang in there. Stay tough. Wash your hands. Wear your mask. We'll catch you soon.
Don't you tell me what to do.
Stay scary.
See ya.